Can I bring this back to the Royal Navy? How can I?
You know what was never gay? The Royal Navy.
Not one time. Not one time has any of those men ever experienced a sexual feeling for another one. That's never happened. Not once.
Never. Never. Hello and welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast which was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about, well, the TV show Barbarians temporarily, until it's about whatever else we want, until it's about the British Navy.
The British Navy would be a really rich vein of material for us. I think there's a lot we could do with the British. What? We got to do Master and Commander. Holy shit.
Oh, fuck. Yeah.
I don't know why that didn't occur to us before.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it's a real dereliction of duty on our part. I'm sorry to the listener that didn't occur to us before.
Yeah,
we really should have been on that.
Yeah, you've watched us come around to this in real time here, or listened to us come around to this in real time. I think we'll probably be doing Master and Commander at some point in the near future.
I reckon so. So if you're a real Jack Aubrey head. Be sure to tune in for that.
Testudo Aubrey.
Yeah. That's one of Riley and November's real obsessions. So,
oceans are now battlefields. I don't know if you know this.
You know what? I've heard it. I've increasingly heard it.
There's just something about a tall ship, a tall wooden ship that really appeals to a man of a certain age. And I'm sorry that I have hit that age. Mm. I don't know when this happened. I don't know to what extent this was connected to other life developments, like fatherhood or whatever. But the tall wooden ship aspect, I've definitely aged into. Like I read the first 14 of the Aubrey Maturin novels. So I really committed pretty hard when the time came. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of like when there's grilling and then like tall wooden ships. I think tall wooden ships for men, they evoke that. Like the time that Trump got to sit in a truck. Do you remember that? And he was it was incredible. Imagine you could just drive away. You could just get in this thing and you could just keep going. That's how men look at a big wooden ship.
I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, I think that the fact that we're largely talking about middle-aged fathers, the idea of going away on a big wooden ship where your family can't reach you for a period of some months does hold some appeal. That may or may not be load-bearing in the enjoying tall wooden ships vein.
Yeah, beautiful. Like, I don't care if I get scurvy.
I mean, scurvy. Have you heard children crying at night? I'll take the scurvy any day.
I wish I had scurvy.
You really want all those old injuries to open back up?
Yeah.
It's like going through your ex's Instagram is the rough equivalent of having scurvy.
Brother, don't get me started on my ex's Instagram. I'm not even going through it. I'm being sent it.
This is why I'm so glad that I never dated in the true age of apps or even really Instagram. Instagram was not even really a thing when I was like dating. So I missed the idea of being sent, like the whole concept of being sent a dating partner's Instagram post is completely beyond me.
Yeah. Yeah. I am sort of, I mean, it's a bit, well, I'm kind of smug about it in a way. Cause I'm just like, well, you know, it's sort of, it's kind of unchic that you're posting about me, but it's very chic that I'm not posting about you. So, this is my new moral compass. Things are either chic or they are not. And I'm trying to be as chic as possible.
That's, unbothered, unbothered, as some might say. Mm.
In my lane, moisturized, flourishing, etc. I'm like the Mudang of the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Mudang is wonderfully moisturized.
A moist gal.
Yeah. Speaking of small animals, I got to see a baby elephant at the Portland Zoo not long ago.
Hell yeah.
Almost a religious experience to see a baby elephant. Yeah, like it was one of one of the coolest things I've ever seen in my life. Gets to see a baby. You get the chance to see a baby elephant. Highly recommend that you take it. Truly adorable and moving.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I'm not like a huge animals guy in general, but there are occasional things that have like really, really stuck with me. And seeing a kangaroo in the wild, like 10 feet away, that was pretty sick. Just like jumped across the road in front of me. I was like, ooh, yeah, that's cool actually.
I saw a meme recently that said something like, kangaroos are just deer that went to prison. And I now can't get that out of my head.
They're prison jacked. Yeah.
Yes. Like the idea of kickboxing a kangaroo is terrifying to me. And I've kickboxed people. Yeah. Like I would much rather kickbox with a person than a kangaroo. Well, that sounds awful.
Sharp talons. Yeah. You don't want that.
Yeah. No, you don't want that at all.
That video of the Australian guy who punches a kangaroo in the face to get his dog back? It's one of the most Queensland videos of all time.
I mean, this is what a move away from subsistence farming and pastoralism has left us with as a society. Is think about how much of the human population would have gotten to see that happen live in the past. And that's been taken from us. We can only experience it on video now. Like that used to just be a Tuesday in Germania.
Yeah. Punch a kangaroo in the face / German equivalent.
I think this has come up before, but I did once see a grown man punch a cow in the face.
What was the context?
A construction site where we had just poured concrete and the cow was wandering toward the wet, fresh concrete. His name was Cliff.
Cliff the cow.
Not the cow. Oh, no, not the cow. The guy who punched him. I don't know what the cow's name was. I'm not sure it had a name. It was like a giant dairy, and it was about 110 degrees Fahrenheit outside, and it was the worst smelling place I'd ever been in my life. But amid that, I did see a man punch a cow. So really, who's to say whether it was a bad day or not?
Dude's fucking rock. Men are class. allow me to say that at this juncture.
So that was 21 years ago, and I could not possibly be more certain that that man is dead.
There is
no way, given his lifestyle and the fact that he hauled off and punched a cow in the face on a dairy job site. I have to assume he's dead now.
Oh, he's that type of building site guy, like phenomenally strong in a very thick way, like eight pints a day, 40 cigarettes a day, dead at 46.
That man is every culture has a version of that guy too. I could not possibly be more certain also that that guy existed in ancient Rome. He lived on the Aventine and he only ate true Roman bread for true Romans. And he drank himself to death.
I've had to punch a goat in the face. It was walking into me daub. When you're trying to do someone's vomitorium and a fucking goat walks in, can't have that. It's going to ruin a day's work. It always steps in me pot garum.
This guy. Okay, so we've just discovered a new trans-historical type of guy. I'd say we're off to a strong start here on today's episode.
Animal face punchers throughout history.
Animal face punchers who, that guy just exists. He's always existed. He's eternal. When he dies, he's reborn in a new body. Yeah. And he continues down through the ages.
I had to fight a deer in Japan once.
What?
Yeah, it was not a deer who'd been to prison, thankfully.
tell me about your deer encounter.
Well, see, Pat, have you ever been to Japan?
No.
So there's a place in Japan. It's between Kyoto and Osaka, right? And it's called Nara. And what Nara is famous for, it's a tiny little town, but it has this big park full of deer, right?
Oh, the tame deer. Yeah. Okay, I've seen that. Yeah, we're kind of tame.
Yeah. It's bullshit, right? Okay, it's a place that women want to go. Because they've seen it on Instagram, and it sucks. It's so bad. Because what you're imagining, right, when it's like, oh, there's this park in Japan and they have these tame deer, right? You're imagining some kind of like beautiful rolling hills national park type scenario, maybe a kind of like mountain in the background, maybe a nice lake or something. This is the kind of park you would get in fucking Hemel Hempstead or Baltimore, or like it's like a half muddy, like piece of shit small urban park, and with all these deer in it, who now supposedly the deer, what they've learned to do is that they bow to you, and then you give them one of these crackers. You can buy these like crackers to feed them, right? But what the deer do sort of bow, but they do it in this very aggressive way where they just come up to you bowing constantly. And if you don't give them a cracker immediately, they start like headbutting you and biting you. These deer are such little cunts. And
but this is I'm prepared to believe that this is a particularly acute problem there, but it's also a general deer problem in that deer are basically giant rats. They breed very quickly. They're highly adaptable. They can live in tons of different environments. They're not particularly smart. Like, their evolutionary advantage is not that they're like good at figuring things out. And they're just kind of dicks. Like, if you ever live in a place that has tons of deer, like urban deer, they're just a pain in the ass. And they need to be hunted more because we've killed all their natural predators. And so now they're just fucking everywhere.
Yeah, well, that's the UK. But anyway, so these deer, right, they're coming up. They're like biting us on the ass. They're like trying to get these. And then there's like a male deer is like coming at me with his antlers. And in the end, I just had to like, grab him by the fucking antlers and like lift his front legs off the ground and be like, fuck off, you little cunt. And then I kind of like threw him backwards. And then he fucked off. But then I was like, if he comes back, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I was like, can I punch a deer in the face? What's the legality of this? Like,
yeah, you absolutely can. Yeah. That's got to be self-defense at that point. Yeah. Because it's not like you were seeking out the deer to fight it. It's not like you had a...
Durden is like, you got to fight a deer your first time at the park.
Yeah, I mean, declaring your supremacy over the deer of Japan, that actually would be pretty baller. I'd just be like, did you know that I'm the king of Japanese deer?
I fought their king.
This is your king? Yeah. This is your king?
He doesn't know any jiu-jitsu.
No, none. Yeah. He doesn't know how to pull guard. Like, what's he going to do? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, that's the beauty of the antlers. You kind of got your guard up all the time. I'm getting in under there with the uppercut straight to the nose. Yeah.
So again, common dude thing, in the sense that like every man has gamed out how he would fight multiple species of animal.
Sure.
Yeah, like there's you like if I tell you, okay, bear. I bet you have not a fully fleshed out plan, but at least an outline of one.
Bear, I'm pretty scared. I'm not going to lie to you. Bear, I'm not confident.
you're not confident? Nah, that's no. Wise. The correct answer is to run. You don't want to fight the bear.
Yeah, God, thank God they can't run.
or climb or swim. Bears have never been known to do any of that.
No. Yeah, my plan with bear is hope I've got a fucking elephant gun. That's my...
Yeah, if it's not 308 Winchester, it's probably not getting the job done there.
Yeah, a gun in a caliber we used to launch gas at the Germans in 1915. Something that has to be towed by three men.
That is maintained by a house gentleman named Nigel. Like, you want something of that size. That's the scale you're looking for here.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas, yeah, deer, I was like, yeah, fuck it. I've got this little.
Yeah, track. No, you go to town there. Like, just give him a nice old 1-2, and off we go.
Yeah. There you go. That's it. Follow the Queensbury rules.
Okay, so. This is the best segue that I can come up with, considering we're talking about fighting deer in an episode of Barbarians. The headdress of the shaman when she was marrying them in this season 1, episode 5 of Barbarians, not period correct. It is based on an archaeological example that's actually about 8,000 years old. It's based on, it's from the Mesolithic, a burial in Germany, a place place called Bad Dürrenberg. But the headdress that the shaman is wearing there is a replica of the Bad Dürrenberg shaman's headdress, which is 6,000 years older.
Well, this is kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? And I think maybe it kind of cuts through the whole of what we discuss on this podcast in general, which is that there's a phenomenon where stuff that's old feels the same to you because it's new. You know, how when you think about the Roman Empire, or Rome as kind of as we conceive of it, or as most people have heard of it, is mostly events that took place between 100 BC and 400 AD. But those are as far apart as now and Henry VIII. But to us, it's all just kind of the same. It's like, yeah, vibes, yeah. Same shit.
It's all Rome. Yeah, 100%. That's absolutely true. And I'm sure that what happened here was they had that had been made as a costume for something, or they were looking for some sort of inspiration for a shamanic headdress, and that's what they found. And to be clear, this isn't a critique of the show for doing that. I think it's a fucking baller looking headdress. And I think that we should go back to wearing rings of elk teeth around our eyes. That's pretty awesome.
Du hast mein Shaman ausgedrippt. Das Headdress ist mega gegoated mit den Sauser.
I mean, this is things that have also been said in a Berlin sex club.
Oh, absolutely.
100%.
Yeah.
I think it looks cool as hell. And I appreciate what they're trying to do in that scene. That to me was the coolest scene in this episode. And so it's not entirely random that I wanted to come back to it, but I think the idea of treating ancient religious traditions that are non-Christian, non-monotheistic, with some seriousness and some sensitivity, it's something I like about the show, is they didn't try to make that a parody or make it seem ridiculous. The people who were involved in it all seem to have believed what they're doing. They come up with even though it's entirely made up, because we have no idea what ancient Germanic religious rituals looked like.
I was going to ask plausible. This because there were bits of it that were quite fruity. And I was the bit where she's painting blood on their chest, and then they just wrap them in a big linen bandage together naked. I was
It's all ethnographically plausible. Basically, what you're doing at that point is, if you want to do a good job of it, and I think they did, is they've basically taken a melange of kind of old seeming marriage customs based on a kind of an understanding of what ancient religion, of what ancient religious belief looked like, and or at least practice. And in this show, something that I think is cool is these characters are constantly doing things that are religious in nature, they're religious acts. It's not so much about statements of religious belief, which actually matches ancient religion pretty well. Ancient religion is much more about practice in the sense of ritual, sacrifice, things like that, than it is about, statements of belief, sacred texts, anything of that nature. So to that extent, I think it's pretty good, and it looks right. The vibes feel right. I thought they kind of nailed the vibe of the whole thing.
Yeah, pretty good vibes, I would say. it captures something. It's funny actually that it's interesting that we know so little about ancient German religious rituals, because obviously the Romans were such big documenters of everything. I remember a while ago having a conversation with someone. I can't remember who this was, but we were talking about Jesus, and then I think they were kind of under the impression that Jesus wasn't real. And then I was like, no, he's a real guy. It might not have been the son of God, but these things they did basically historically occur. And then they were really off put by this. They were like, how would you possibly know that? And I'm like, the Romans, they fucking wrote shit down, man. Yeah.
this was a text-based culture. Yeah. These people were literate, lots of them. Knew how to read and write. They used writing for, you wouldn't believe all the things they used reading and writing for. That's
graffiti about how big their cock is, etc.
One of the absolute classics of the human endeavor, drawing pictures of dicks.
Oh yeah.
As old as time. Dicks and boobs. We've been doing it. The fucking Venus of Willendorf, man. Like we've been at this for a while. So yeah, it was, but interesting counterpoint to that, to your point about why don't we know more about ancient Germanic religion? Mm-hmm. The Romans did document lots of things. We know that at least some Romans were interested in what was happening beyond the frontiers of the empire. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, I think most of the people who fit that description would have been living and working along the frontier already. They would have been largely military, or merchants, people like that. And those are people who didn't leave us a lot of lengthy narrative texts from the Roman world. Like if we look at what are the lengthy texts that survive, they tend to be histories, poems, letters, things like that. We know that people along the Roman frontiers were literate and did write letters. We know because they left funeral inscriptions. That in a couple of rare cases, like at Vindolanda in Britain, there are actual surviving letters written by soldiers. They were preserved on organic materials there. The Vindolanda tablets, they're some of my favorite Latin texts. Super cool, super interesting. So we know that this happened, but those are not the kinds of things that get saved, even for a generation, much less copied down over and over again in manuscripts in the way that makes it down to us. Also, my guess is that a lot of Roman professional cultures were highly oral in nature. Mm-hmm. We think of the Romans as very textual, and they were to an extent, but Roman artisan culture, like non-elite professional culture in Rome, was largely oral. There were some written texts that circulated and were used, but knowledge was basically passed down orally through set paths. And I wonder how much the military mirrored that. They used the written word for record keeping, administration, logistics, supplies, things like that. But for like conveying information about what things are like or how things are done, I wonder if their preferred medium wasn't more oral. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. It's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, this is so like the end of things that I know little about in classics, because I was really like a philosophy guy. The limit of my probably fucking Roman military history stuff is Caesar's De Bello Gallico or a bit of like Livy book 22. Amazing that Livy survives despite being one of the most boring things ever written.
Oh, dude, I'm having to reread Livy right now to write my Hannibal episodes, and Livy just unbelievably ponderous, boring, can't even copy Polybius right when he's copying Polybius. Like it's just like he manages to fuck up, like even where he is literally copying Polybius's text, Livy still screws it up. Like he introduces details that have no basis in anything, like things that are things that are made up. He gets numbers wrong. He transposes numbers. He clear points where he misread something and just doubles it. And he's like, yeah, so they did this twice. what are you talking about, man?
In the Polybius cule.
I'm very Polybius pilled right now. This is, but okay. So these are things like in terms of military culture and literacy, orality, kind of the idea of professional cultures. These are relatively new topics in classical studies, because for the reason that you pointed to, like the kind of training that you got was much more philological, literary, interested in things like that. Whereas classical archaeology has traditionally been an entirely separate branch. Right. Yeah, not all that much carryover between them.
Yeah. So, there was an option to do that, but I was like, nah, I don't want to get in a hole. miss me with the hole. Put me in the literature class with the cute chicks. That was me. Yeah.
But I will say there are some very cute girls on archaeological digs for any of our younger listeners who are wondering what to go into.
Career advice with Milo Patrick.
Career advice. Yeah. So there is an alternate world in which I am an archaeologist who lives in Ireland. When I was finishing my master's degree, One of the options that I discussed was staying there to do archaeology with a guy named Kieran O'Connor, who was cool as hell. He was awesome. But right. Yeah, one night he and I were very drunk and we were just blasting darts at the college bar.
Beautiful.
And we got to talking about battlefield archaeology, and he's like, yeah, you know, I've got money. We're thinking about excavating the Boyne battlefield. Like, come work with me. It'll be fun. So
the Battle of the Boyne from every British person's calendar. Finally.
Yeah, it would have been cool as hell.
They put that in your fucking calendar if you live in the UK. It's like a meme hilarious. In Britain where people are like, happy Battle of the Boyne Day, because no one knows what the fuck it is.
That's fucking hilarious. Yeah. Okay, it's 1688. It's a whole thing. We don't need to go into it. Yeah. But yeah, I do think about that from time to time. Like, I would probably live somewhere outside of Dublin and work for a commercial archaeology company in Ireland. Like,
beautiful. Hauntology, yeah, Lost Patricks.
Okay. So again, these are kind of new topics in Roman studies, but there's a lot of interesting work that's being done on them. And so, like, I think there probably would have been a fair few people in the Roman Empire who knew quite a bit about barbarian customs, language, culture, who could have given you probably a pretty good description of what a wedding ritual looks like in Germania. Yeah. Like, think about how many Roman military officers or merchants were invited to some local Germanic chieftain's daughter's wedding, right? Mm-hmm. Like, think about how many people that is over the centuries, where I'm sure somebody went, I'm sure somebody talked about it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So,
but that's just not the kind of stuff that makes it into the written record about that world. And it's an interesting, it's kind of an interesting commentary on what we know about history or what gets passed down, like what aspects of lived reality are just kind of gone forever. Mm.
And also, I guess even if things that are recorded, like what gets preserved for various reasons, because like sort of, I think in more modern history, you've just got like so much more shit is being written down just because that's like it. Pen and paper is readily available and cheap, right? So you've got like the kind of the equivalent of this in like the 19th century, like fucking British army officer in like India or Africa or whatever is like writing down a lot of shit, and that stuff still exists because it was like sent home whereas probably your average Roman legate is probably not writing down a huge amount because that would have been quite an expensive enterprise. So your account of the German wedding just kind of goes around the camp and then that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting to think about kind of the information worlds of a period in the past, or how the information world of the Roman army is and is not connected to broader Roman civilian society, right? Like, that's, so did people write home? I'm not sure we really know. I think we know of oral messages being passed back and forth. But I don't know if we know about like any soldiers or writing home, really. I guess Caesar writing his dispatches.
Yeah, in HBO's Rome, Varinus comes home and his whole family are like, we thought you were dead. You were gone for like 5 years. We just sort of assumed you weren't coming back, man.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, I was. All good.
Yeah, with a penis of a Swabian.
Well, it's like literally, though, if you're, the Roman Empire was so much of like dad going out for cigarettes and not coming back, but actually coming back after 5 years and then being like, oh yeah, sorry, that the shop was actually further than I thought.
You've basically just described the entire Roman experience in Iberia up to the first century BC. It's just like guys going off for 5 years and getting lost in the meseta and finally coming back with like two Spanish girlfriends.
The dream.
This is a thing that actually happens. There's in the second century BC, a group of some 4,000 sons of Roman fathers and Iberian women petitioned the Senate for Roman citizenship.
Because they're like, look, beautiful sons.
Yeah, I mean, so like they really were there for a while, you know, like they were out there. But that's it. The Roman army, again, I'm not sure if this is how much we've talked about this, is not Roman civilian society, especially by this point. It isn't in Caesar's time, and it becomes increasingly less so as we reach the time of barbarians, where like the army, these guys are institutionalized. They're out there for a long time, a long way away from the mainstream of Roman culture. And that the culture the barbarians are exposed to, the version of Roman culture that they get, is Roman military culture, not Roman civilian culture of the imperial core.
Yeah, yeah, they're getting there. Yeah, could you imagine? I was going to say, could you imagine this? But I feel like actually this is probably true. Like this is like when you think like if you're not quite to the same extent, but if you're like, if you've grown up in Afghanistan in the last 20 years, your exposure to American culture is like American troop culture. You're like, damn, yeah. Americans really love wanking in a porta shitter. Like, that's like, you know, and, it's your conception of it.
And would they be wrong? No, they probably like think the white monster energy drink is some sort is like Soma. It is a religious ritual beverage consumed by Americans before battle. Like,
yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. No, it's an interesting question. I mean, I would love to interview Afghans and hear what they think about that.
You Americans love chewing tobacco and saying things like sucking the day's dick. This is important to your culture.
I picked the wrong time to hit the pendulum there, brother. yeah. So it's interesting, right? Like there's, because in this show, I think this is one way in which Arminius is a kind of an unusual example of these types of guys in Roman history more broadly, like Roman and barbarian history, is because the way Arminius is being presented here is that he has also been exposed to Roman civilian culture in a way that would not have been true for the vast majority of barbarians. And when they're talking about Romans and being Romanized, they're talking about guys like Arminius. It's not so much the culture of the Roman army camp, which is much different. And I don't know. I'm interested in this dynamic, though. And I love the way that this show plays with Arminius's identities. It's such an interesting kind of central device. Is like it's every character, every good character has to answer some fundamental question about themselves. Right. Like, is this the thing I want? Do I want to go here? Well, like, what do I want? And in this show, the fundamental question is, who am I? And that's a really, really interesting thing if you can pull it off. And I think they do a pretty good job of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's an interesting character. And of course, a real person also.
A real person. Yeah. Yeah. This type of guy existed for centuries all along the Roman frontier. We know Arminius and we know what Arminius did, but the vast majority of these guys we don't know. They did exist. We know they did. This was how the Romans managed what happened beyond their borders. It was a very successful playbook for them. It worked for a really long time over a really long stretch of frontier. Especially, it worked really well along the middle and upper Danube and kind of the upper Rhine. So that kind of stretch where the Roman frontier takes kind of a big turn north of the Alps, that whole area, they did that very successfully for a really long time. You can see the archaeological evidence. You can see people with symbols of Roman authority beyond the frontier. And you can surmise this is one of the big material changes in that region in this period is the increasing use of Roman symbols of power, Roman kind of cultural markers as symbols of prosperity, power, and authority. Like we see them at high status sites. And in high status burials.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like that kind of, you know, it's like how everyone all over the world, people are using US dollars. Well, I mean, maybe not so much anymore, but like, it's that kind of, when you become the sort of the predominant force, even beyond the frontier, there's still this element of like, well, that's kind of the standard that applies to stuff. It's interesting. Well, cause I think also, I mean, this is like this, as a character kind of like stands athwart history, right? Where he's like kind of like German but Roman, and then sort of seeing where does his future lie. Because I think what's interesting about the show, because they do this whole thing where it's like, oh, well, the Romans are doing this to us and we have to stop them and whatever. But then it's also like, there are a bunch of people who are saying, like, you're not gonna stop the Romans. Like, what are you talking about? That's not, you know, that's not an option. The option is how you deal with the Romans. It's not like, there's no option where the Romans go away. And I think that's kind of interesting, because I think it's sort of, when you conceive of history on like a long timeline, like some cultures just win and others lose. Like you get like, you know, how there's sort of, like there's basically no Celts in Britain anymore. Like they were all kind of like taken out of existence by like Germanic tribes, and like, you know, the Picts were all killed by the Irish, and like there's just like some cultures just completely disappear from the map.
Yep.
And so there's an interesting thing where he's kind of negotiating that, like, well,
yeah, which, because this is a real process. There, the even that region had mostly been Celtic speaking 300 years before this. The Germanic speaking peoples were relative newcomers to that region at this time. Like that is a process that occurred in historical times, even if it wasn't historically documented. Iron Age Central Europe pre 100, 150 BC was largely Celtic speaking. And it was part of the Latin material culture complex, which extended basically all the way to kind of Western Ukraine. So this is a pretty unified material culture complex. Linguistically, it was mostly Celtic speaking, broadly, like a lot of similarities over this really broad region. Germanic speaking peoples, and there's interesting new ancient DNA evidence on this topic, that really only starts, it's only really noticeable in the genetic and material record 100 BC, right around the time we're talking about. So like these people had not been the residents of this place since time immemorial. They too had done the same thing. You know, there's probably some questions there that we could explore. But yeah. Sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought.
No, but it is, and I think we don't, in the modern world, we don't really think about that kind of stuff as much, because things are a bit more like static than they were in the ancient world. But it's sort of interesting, like there are so many like just kind of entire like cultures from that period that just don't exist anymore, or like ethnic groups that don't really exist anymore, or at least not in any meaningful sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true now, but these things happen over periods of time that to us seem extremely long in the present when we think about 100 years or 200 years. But when we look at especially the archaeological record, because change is relatively speaking so slow and is very rarely abrupt, we're used to thinking of those things as successive kind of cultures, successive things mapping on top of the other.
Yeah.
When really they're kind of, it's one bleeds into the next, which is what's happening in the present when you look at kind of the superseding of one ethnic identity by another, the rise in popularity of a new national identity. Like those are also relatively, those processes happen relatively slowly relative to, or if we're thinking about it from our perspective in time, it's pretty short if we're looking at it with the same kind of temporal perspective that we would use when looking at the turn of the millennium.
Yeah, yeah. Every fucking historical period gets its Trump turning off the global economy moment.
It's true. It's true. They're all stupid in their own way. Maybe not this stupid, but they are all pretty stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Look, like, I'm sure there was like a Roman podcast being inscribed on a wax tablet in like the first century AD, being like, this Caligula guy, fucking crazy, man.
Yeah. Well, think about like the fall of the Soviet Union not that long ago. Very dumb. Invasion of Iraq. Very dumb.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Really powerfully stupid guy energy. I'm old enough to remember how stupid it seemed at the time. And so I think it's probably, we will probably in hindsight make this seem less stupid. And that's one of the great tricks that history plays on you, is you you assign more cogency over you remove a lot of the lack of clarity from the record as you tell the story back over time. Like, it's always muddied and confused and fucking weird. And then, you know, give it 10 years and we'll settle on one or two narratives of what happened and we'll cut out all of the inconvenient bits that don't fit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, history is like the movie version. You know, everyone's being played by a hotter actor. You know, the dialogue is better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Donald Trump's being played by like Alec Baldwin or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this, we're gonna put a higher tariff on China. It's incredible just to put America first. Okay. When has America ever been first? We're gonna do it for the first time, actually. We're looking into that very strongly.
I saw a clip of a Trump administration official saying something like, yeah, you know, after World War II, when we really engaged with the global economy, the American economy just went straight downhill. Like, all right. Yeah. Okay. All right. That's the kind of thing that makes me want to walk headfirst into a peat bog and just become a bog body.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I often think about how Britain was the only country that actually paid back its World War II debt to America.
Which silly. Never should have done that.
Closest friend and ally. We're such dumb cucks. Honestly, like, we're incredible.
Dude, there's a line at the beginning of David Graeber's book on debt, where he's describing an interaction he had with like an economist or something. And he's like, I got the idea to write this book because I told this person that I was talking about debt. And she said, well, one must pay one's debts, mustn't one? And it's the most British shit I've ever heard.
Yeah.
The way that that's phrased, but also the sentiment where I'm like, you are that incredibly Bank of England pilled right there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We as a country need to get into our SCSI era. We need to start welching.
Yeah, you need to get real Albanian with it. You know what I mean?
Building bunkers, putting a big black eagle on stuff.
Yeah, you and Enver Hoxha, like, yeah.
Oh, bring him back.
Yeah,
bring him back.
I mean, maybe just more Balkan in general.
Well, this reminds me of when I was talking about, I think it was Dua Lipa. Or it was either Dua Lipa or Rita Ora. And I made some joke about her being Albanian. And my ex went, she's not Albanian, she's from Kosovo. And I was like, this is so perfect because you don't know you're accidentally just like walking into the world's most aggressive sectarian debate. And then I had to give her the short version of why most Kosovans were Albanian. I'm like, but don't say that in Serbia.
Oh my God.
Or parts of Kosovo.
Again, that's fucking hilarious. you got to backdoor explain several centuries of Balkan history through the lens of a current pop star.
It was so funny because she thought that she'd just like got me on not knowing my pop divas. Like, well, actually, she's not Albanian, she's from Kosovo. Just like accidentally opening the fucking sectarian arc of the government, having your fucking face melted by a ray of pure light. 4 million YouTube comments later.
Yeah, look, you really do not want to dive into the world of ethnic nationalism in ex-Ottoman territories. Ooh. That's advanced level stuff right there.
Yeah.
I mean, because you really get to pick from a bunch of different toxic nationalisms there. Like, you get, Arab nationalism, pretty messed up, all in the old Ottoman Empire. You know, a Balkan nationalism, old Ottoman Empire, Turkish nationalism nowadays. Erdogan, not great.
Yeah.
Nice drones, but not great.
Oh, God, Turkey. Spicy NATO. they have like the gayest straight culture on the planet, which I like. Their traffic cops wear tight leather trousers. But also, like, the Turkish government is like, we are not gay constantly. It's like, they're really, like, the oil wrestling, like, all of it is like so. There's such a horseshoe theory between homophobia and homoeroticism, which I always find fascinating.
And you ascribe that particular horseshoe to the noble equestrian Turks. Turkey. What a fascinating place. Just a land of hair transplants and coffee and fantastic ethno-nationalism.
So also, I'm going to have to confess, read this episode, that I'm a little bit lost with the plot, because so I watched episode 4 yesterday in the gym, but I had to watch it on my phone, and that meant that I didn't get the subtitles. So I watched it in German, and I did my best.
Does that mean you didn't get the Latin either?
Nope. At least I know Latin. I was doing better with the Latin than I was with the German, let me tell you.
Oh my God. Okay, this is perfect.
That's
all
me
right,
being
okay.
Like, how does that verb conjugate? Is that future perfect?
Oh my God. So you got the full cultural immersion experience. Yeah. What was that like?
I was there. I was in the Roman army camp. It was, I was also lifting at the time. Of course, in honor of this pod.
Absolutely. Gotta be jacked.
I was kind of like, damn. Because actually, something I thought this at uni when we're, you know, doing Latin and ancient Greek, is that they're very hard to learn, because it's very difficult to like immerse yourself in them. Like, that Latin is not much more complicated than Russian, really, but you have to, but the fact that you can just like go to a bar and speak to Russians makes Russian so much easier to learn.
Learn Latin and Greek, any dead language, you have to approach them less as languages in the way that we would treat something we're approaching in the modern day, and more almost as like learning a computer, like a coding language. The easiest way to learn them is to approach them entirely structurally. That's not the best way to get sense out of them as you're reading them, but it's the, like, I think you, when you learn them that way, it's mechanical, but it's effective, but you don't really get, I don't think you get great nuances of meaning. I don't think you get that fun stuff, but it's certainly easier to learn them that way.
Yeah. Cause you're doing like rule following. And I remember, now I studied Latin from the age of like 11. So by the time I was at Cambridge, my Latin was like pretty decent, but, my Greek was pretty bad and is still bad now. There was a brief period where my Greek was okay, and then I forgot it all again. But I remember that we had to do these composition classes, right? Like once a week, I would go and I would sit with my director of studies, and he would go through a page of Latin that I'd written, translated from like an English like guide text that I'd been given. And this was very funny, because he would always like, he would make himself like a gigantic cup of tea. He had one of those offices where it was like stacks of papers and books everywhere in a way that looked incredibly like chaotic, but he could like find everything. It was like real kind of savant energy. Anyway, so there I am. And then one time I'd translated something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I'd used some kind of form that was like, it was grammatically correct, but it was unattested because I'd just applied a rule. And then he looks at it and he goes, And then he like, he puts on his little half moon glasses and he wanders over to a bookshelf and he takes down a huge leather bound Latin grammar, like a solid 2 kilo book, and then comes and like puts it down on the desk and he like leafs through it. And then he runs his finger down a page and he goes, just as I feared. And then he slams his fist on the table and goes, "You're condemned by Quintilian." And if you ever wondered what learning Latin is like,
he used the phrase "condemned by Quintilian."
Yeah.
To you?
Yeah. But for the listener, Quintilian is a famous Latin grammarian.
Yeah. Like, so you got to have, leaving aside the pure hilarity of that moment, I want to step to the side. Just point out, you had him saying that to you gave you an experience that has been shared by students for the past 2000 years. You got to be another in a long line of students who have been condemned by Quintilian. you fall into a noble tradition. Like, I bet Martin Luther got condemned by Quintilian at some point in his career. Like, you got to, like, look at you just standing amid the current of history. in a way that connects you to long distant ancestors.
Oh yeah. And also this guy was the most like Cambridge Don guy of all time, brackets non-derogatory. Like he was like true, like old school eccentric, but in like such a cool, like he was obsessed with sundials.
Hell yeah.
And he is like a Byzantine historian.
What was his name? Okay, I don't know him, but that sounds, yeah. is a fantastic Cambridge Don name. I want to throw that out there. Well, it's like Kenny Powers for a baseball player.
Well, yeah, and he used to go on about how because of his late antiquity interests, Oxford insisted on giving him a PhD in modern history. And then he would be like, Oxford. And then he'd be like, interesting view on the world that they have.
Oh my God. See, yeah. this is the shit you don't get in the United States. You just don't get it like this. This is some really good Brit posting here.
Oh, and it was all like, he was always involved in like petty beefs. Like he said that, he was like, I have never received a freedom of information request that was not in some way vexatious. Cause he was like the senior tutor of the college. And he was like, for this reason, I don't maintain any college disciplinary records. He's like, now, I do remember all of the college disciplinary incidents, but they can't freedom of information request your own mind. Like, that's between me and God. It's like, you know, Philip Pander discovered that, you know, you could, records could be freedom of information request, and was like, right, no more records. And you know what? Fair play to that.
I mean, I feel like that works pretty well for MI5 also.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Actually, there was one more thing that he told me once, which really made me lose it, which was, have you heard of that? There's a Latin scholar called E.J. Kenny from like way back in the day.
The name rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, I mean, he must have been born probably in like the late 19th century, I would have thought. He was a fellow at my college, right? But he obviously, he died like long before, probably before I was born even. But when my director of studies was first a fellow there, probably in like the early 70s, this guy was still around. And he said that... that was it. I think it was, so he was having a birthday party, right? And it was his 100th birthday party. And then his director of studies, who was an emeritus fellow and was somehow still alive, or maybe it was a 90th birthday party. I'm trying to get the details of this story right now. I think, no, E.J. Kenny was the one, the older one. So there was some other fellow, like a relatively eminent ancient historian who was having like a 90th birthday party and was still a fellow of the college. And then Pandan's like, so I'm hosting this birthday party in the fellow's dining room, right? He's like, and then suddenly as we're starting the meal, his director of studies comes into the room, who was E.J. Kenny, aged 110. He was like, enters the room on two walking sticks like a cross-country skier, and then proceeds to sit down and hold court for the entire afternoon. He was like, basically no one else spoke. It was like, a man with an age of ghost. Like, just...
That's, again, something you just could not get in the United States. That's not a possibility here. There is no venue or institution that could host multiple centenarians in a single sitting.
Yeah.
Much less one dedicated to ancient history.
I don't know what it is about classics professors. They all live to the age of like 146, but they're, yeah.
It's clean living.
Yeah. Yeah. Clean living. Reading a lot of Latin and hanging out.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think as the disciplines go, they certainly live longer than archaeologists do. Archaeologists, they tend to get after it pretty hard, I would say. Well, I don't think that's as long-lived a profession.
More danger of falling down holes than getting melanoma and stuff like that.
that's true. More natural hazards in the archaeologists' world than in the classicists, I would say.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So you watched the fourth episode,
yeah,
through language immersion at the gym, and which made this one perhaps the plot a little harder to follow. Okay. Basically, Arminius is trying to figure out what he's going to do, and he's got a plan. And the plan involves telling Varus that he's going to gather up the sons of the various Riks, the various kings, and they're going to hold them as hostages for Rome. He does get them. He goes around and he seizes them all. Very triggering for Arminius. Very triggering for Arminius in ways that he points out in, I think, a pretty good monologue. Pretty good monologue from old Arminius there. And so he gives the sons back, but he tells Varus that that the Reeks refuse to hand their sons over. And he's going to use this as the bait to lure Varus into a trap, using all of the soldiers that he has, or using all of the warriors that he has accumulated from his charismatic plan to get the various Reeks on his side.
I see. And then in and amongst this, he gets married.
Yes, he is now with Tusnelda, the lovely Tusnelda, and the Volkvin Wolfspear, meanwhile, has been taken as a slave, and the Romans do not know who he is. They do not know that he is the infamous Volkvin Wolfspear.
Yeah. So what was the by what mechanic did he ended up being taken as a slave?
He was getting shit faced by himself at the fire in the woods, and a Roman slave trading or slave raiding group happened on him as he was drunk in the forest, trying to forget about Tusnelta's wedding.
Classic.
So he got bonked on the head yet again. Fulkfin is going to end this series with CTE if he doesn't already have it.
Oh, he's getting bonked so much. He's like
a lot of bonking.
He's getting more bonking than Boris Johnson in about 2006. Bonk constantly.
Yeah, constant bonking. Yeah. That's a good title for like a PBS series in the United States. A constant bonking.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, because we also get a bit where Segestes, everyone's favorite little bitch, is like watching the wedding happen, and he's like, he didn't even ask by permission. They're like, what are you going to do? Call the Roman cavalry?
that was a pretty sick burn.
Yeah. Call your mates the Roman cavalry, you little bitch.
But again, as we've discussed, during the period of Roman expansion and kind of Roman pressure along the frontiers, there were a lot more Segestes than there were Arminiuses. There were a lot more guys who were like, you know what? This ain't so bad. And the other thing that this gets right is that Roman power, when it arrived, didn't flatten things. Roman power kind of courses through the channels and networks that are already there. So this is a really common pattern whenever an imperial power shows up anywhere, is that very quickly the imperial power gets drawn into local factional struggles. And because somebody is like, oh, we could, these new powerful guys are here, we can use them. We can, they will help us win power in our village, or they'll help us be the oligarch of this city or the king of this small kingdom or what have you. Sure. That happens everywhere the Romans go, everywhere. And the Romans know this, and it's a key cornerstone of the way that they do policy, right? Like they're aware of this dynamic, they encourage it, and it works really well for them. So while Segestes is not the good guy here, there were a lot of guys like Segestes out there who were perfectly happy and perfectly willing to work with Roman power in any way possible to further their own local position.
Yeah, the most useful basic unit of the Roman Empire, the local little bitch.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like the scholarship gets around this in all sorts of ways. You know, it talks about local acquiescence to Rome or, local factions supporting Rome. But yeah, a lot of the time it was just some dude who nobody liked, but who was willing to kind of be like, yeah, okay, I'm your guy. And the Romans were always looking for that guy. Always.
Yeah. Yeah. And it feels like that. Yeah. And it is throughout history, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, it's like in like Nazi occupied France or whatever. Suddenly the guy who's in charge is like local grass. Like, Pierre de Grasse. Oh, actually, I'm getting a free bottles of wine from the commandant. So I'm telling him where all of these seditious elements are. And you're like, oh, yeah. That fucking guy.
Yeah, this guy has always existed. During the American Revolution, right? There are pretty good statistics on this through much of the 13 colonies. Like, what percentage of the population was actually actively rebelling? And it was almost never higher than a third of the total population was in active rebellion. Even in the areas that were most full of those sentiments, it's like half in Massachusetts. Mm. Even in Massachusetts, which is like the center of this, of the popular rebellion aspect of the American Revolution,
might have been there, like half down the, different.
Yeah, there's like still like only half the people were in. Mm. So like, it's really when we approach past populations as if they were monolithic entities, whether that we're talking about Romans or Germanic peoples or tribes or whoever, or nations or colonies, like when we assume that there were no divisions of opinion within those entities, we're doing them a disservice and we're making the past a lot less interesting than it actually was.
You know what? You know what, Pat? What, I think that's such a sound place to leave this.
we've really brought a lot of chaotic energy to our duo episodes, and I for one am very happy about that.
Absolutely, yeah. It's sort of very I was saying this to Phoebe last time. It's great that this is three different podcasts now. Each it's chaotic a in their own way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this was really fun. And I'm pretty, I'm actually a little bit jealous that you and Phoebe get to discuss episode 6 together next time without me. So do us some justice, pals.
I'll do my best. I'll do my best. Keep her on track as far as I can. she'll keep me on track as best as she can. Yeah, thanks for being, I think this is a Patreon one. Thank you for being a Patreon subscriber. You're the best. You make the show possible. Without you, there is no barbarians discussion. There are no tales of fucking the centenarian Cambridge professors. There's no discussion of the persistence of the cow puncher throughout history. So
yeah, this particular oral culture would be lost to you.
That's correct. Yeah. So if you wish this oral culture to continue in the annals of history, then please do carry on as you are. Yeah. If you're at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, I'm here until the 20th of April doing shows, so please do come and see those. We do need to sell tickets. If you're in Ireland also, I'm on tour in late May and early June in a bunch of cities. Those are all on my website. Thanks.
That is a lovely time to be in Ireland.
Yeah, hopefully. You can like never quite bank on Irish weather, but I reckon there's a decent chance. I've never spent a huge amount of time in Ireland, so I'm pretty keen. I'm a fan of the Irish. I'm a fan of Ireland in general, so I think it should be a fun little trip.
Pretty cool.
All right, cracking. Well, we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.